Going to do a few different things tonight, but I'll try to connect them and make this coherent. I think I discovered why I was invited here this weekend. It was, as Father said in his homily this morning, it's appropriate that I should be here for the Feast of St. Thomas, as Father referred to him in the homily as someone who was tall and not thin. So in that sense, I think it's appropriate that I am here on this particularly delightful feast day. I want to take some time at the beginning of this talk tonight, and then I'll stop earlier than I did last night, leave time for questions. I know some of you had questions that you didn't get a chance to ask last night, so I'll try to leave some time tonight so you may ask those questions. But I was making the claim last night that the loved one is a great work of art. And I want to start by defining what I mean by that. That is, how can one know, or what are the standards by which one can judge greatness? Now, usually time takes care of that. As time goes on, it becomes increasingly clear which works are great. They are the ones that somehow are able to transcend their own age and speak with a voice of those eternal truths, and therefore speak to all men in all times. But that demands that history take over, and that time go on, and there is an awareness of the transcendence of a particular age, a particular time. If you had asked the man on the street in Shakespeare's own age who the great writer of the age was, the response would have been Ben Jonson. And if you'd asked for number two, it probably would have been Beaumont and Fletcher. And if you'd asked about Mr. Shakespeare, he might have come in third or fourth, and they all liked him, and he was very popular. But in his own time, even though he was hugely popular, most people would have been surprised that his was the name that would come to be the most renowned of the age. The one who knew it, of course, was Ben Jonson, who in the elegy that he wrote at the beginning of the first folio, the first collection of Shakespeare's works, says he was not of an age, but for all time. And there was a case of another artist who could recognize great art. And there was a friendly rivalry. It must have killed Ben Jonson to admit that. But he knew it. He somehow knew that Shakespeare was the great figure and would be that great figure for all time, not just for a single age. Well, what do you do with contemporary works? Because there's a lot being published. And if you read the current book reviews, if you pick up the New York Times Sunday Book Review, you have the masterpiece of the week. There's a new genius that comes along every week, and there are masterpieces being turned out the way that factories bottle Coca-Cola. It's just it's supposedly this flood of great writing. Well, of course, that's not the case. And in any age, there are only a few figures that stand out. And I would say in our own age, which is not an age of great art, there will be even fewer figures that stand out. But I would make the claim that Mr. Waugh is one of them, that he is a genius, that these works will survive, that they will last. What's the basis on which I make that claim? Well, let me start with this. An artist, in order to be great, first has to begin with a great idea. Now, this may seem strange to us in one sense, but I would ask you to consider what has happened in the field of modern art. If you go to a modern art museum, one of the great galleries, you can go to the Metropolitan Museum in New York City or go to the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., and you go through that gallery beginning with classical art, the Greeks and the Romans, and then keep walking through until you come to the medieval art, and then the Renaissance galleries, and then the 18th century, and then the Impressionists, and then up to the modern age. One thing that you're going to discover is not just that the art itself changes, but that the idea being presented changes. And this is something that modern critics and modern audiences have completely forgotten. One of the problems with modern art, and one reason that most people make jokes about modern art, and when they go in and see those canvases, a giant white canvas with a splotch of black in the middle, is that that canvas has no subject matter. It is without reference. And the modern artist will simply say, well, I am merely interested in structure and style and making a statement with my paint. I don't have to say anything. Well, the fact of the matter is, if you go back to the Greeks, you have magnificent statuary of gods and goddesses and heroes. You have great subject matter. If you walk into the medieval galleries, you are going to have crucifixions, Madonnas and childs, and a whole range of them, often repeated over and over again, but with incredible variety, in which the individual artists give distinctive shape and form to that subject matter, but the subject matter, the idea behind it, is a great idea. Those artists were tackling great ideas. And the fact of the matter is that any artist who hopes to create anything that is of lasting interest has to tackle big material. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that a small work of art cannot also be lasting. A small little sonnet by Keats, for example, where he gives voice, the sonnet beginning, "When I have fears that I may cease to be." The young man aware of his tuberculosis, afraid of what's happening. It's a small little poem. It's a lovely little poem, okay? It is an exquisite, it's an exquisite work of art. It is still tackling a grand idea. It is a man confronting death and being fearful at the confrontation of death. So it's, there's still a great idea there. You can have a tiny little portrait that can be a great work of art, because in trying to capture a human personality, the artist is, in a sense, taking on a great subject. Because in order to capture the uniqueness of an individual, the individual soul that is expressed through the form, the physical form, and to render that is to attempt to display or execute a great idea. Now, the point I would make is that there are various things that an artist can do. One is, and it's one of the artist's jobs, in tackling that great idea, an artist can try to describe an age, okay? One of the first duties of an artist, and therefore one of the first ideas that an artist can attempt to tackle, is give an impression of the world in which the artist finds himself. Because the world changes over time. An artist finds himself located in a particular time and place and can give a rendering of what that time and place was like. This, in one sense, is Shakespeare's vision, which he puts in the mouth of Hamlet, who says that the duty of the players, and in speaking about the players, those who are creating art, have a duty to hold the mirror up to nature. That is, render something that is true and lifelike, give the age as it exists. This can be a great idea, attempting to capture a time and a place, and it can become a transcendent idea. If it is well done, and I'll get to that in a moment, then it can transcend time and place and tell us about something beyond time and place. Now, it is possible to do just that and have something that is interesting. That is not, however, necessarily great art. Let me give an example. We were having a conversation yesterday, and I admitted something that I only occasionally admit publicly, and that is that I have a secret little soft spot in my heart for the wacky modern pop artist named Andy Warhol. Now, this was a man that I would never claim produced great art, but he had a clear sense of the world in which he lived. And the fact of the matter is, I have always been a little bit attracted by those huge canvases on which he painted Campbell's tomato soup cans. This is on the surface of it, a ridiculous thing to do. There is another way in which Warhol was holding a mirror up to nature and capturing something about us. He was doing it as a kind of joke, but the joke was he knew full well that he was born into and lived in a materialistic age. And living in a materialistic age, what was the major concern of the people who surrounded him and the life as it was lived around him? Stuff. Material. So what he does is take one material object, a most peculiar one, an ordinary one, an everyday one. He takes a can of Campbell's tomato soup, takes a big canvas, and paints a magnificent reproduction of the soup can on a canvas. It's a joke of a kind. At the same time, it is holding a mirror up to nature in that you look and say, what is this doing? What does it tell us about life in the middle of the 20th century? They were obsessed with stuff. There's no humanity there. People aren't there. It's a junky tin can. Now, not great art. Not necessarily a great idea. But an idea. And a joke. And something to do with our time. Now, please notice, as I said last night, Waugh, in this novel, when he hits California, is also aware that the modern world is materialistic. And that idea is woven throughout the novel, but it is turned into something else because it becomes one strand in a larger work, a larger fabric, and what he is really talking about is the nature of death itself. That is a grand idea. He has tackled an enormous idea. And beyond that, he has tackled the idea from his perspective as a Catholic and is trying to reach an audience to say something about the nature of death and how death itself has been transformed in our time and get them to still read the work, take it seriously, have some sense of what he's talking about, make some sort of impression on them. Little commentary. I'm going to quote later tonight from this work. It's a lovely work by a critic named Frederick Beatty, talking about Waugh's work. At the end of his book, which is called The Ironic World of Evil and Waugh, published just recently, he makes this point. He says, Evil and Waugh attracts such a diversity of admirers, from those who regard him as a brilliant entertainer to those who read him for religious enlightenment, that his appeal cannot be accounted for on the basis of any single attribute in his writing. And it's very interesting. This Catholic novelist reached a huge audience. He managed to reach an audience that was not necessarily Catholic and get them to read his work and get him to respond, perhaps not in necessarily the exact way he wanted, but he got them reading. He kept them reading. This is an amazing thing to do. And what is the artist's duty? To reach a public. That in and of itself is a difficult job these days, because the fact of the matter is, you go to an art gallery and you walk in and most people see the Warhol Campbell soup can and they walk out of the gallery. They walk in and see the big canvas with paint just thrown on it and they say, well, what's that? That's, you know, I don't know much about art, but I know what I like and I don't like that. And it is a kind of human response, and the audience is being lost. In the field of music, the overturning of tonality, Schoenberg's 12-tone system where there's not tonality, and all of those orchestra concerts where they sandwich a modern work between a Rossini overture and a Beethoven symphony, and the poor audience is trapped there and has to endure this noise because they want to stay for the Beethoven, which they know they like, and they arrive early because they think Rossini's delightful. Therefore, they have to endure this misery, and they just complain and complain about it. There is no audience for it. It's like, this is good for you, you have to eat it, okay? It's forcing bad vegetables down the child's throat, but in this case, there isn't any nutritional value. There's nothing there. It's bad, and the audience knows it. Waugh was a modern artist who reached a large audience. And he did so in ways that surprised, delighted, entertained them. And as he always said, one of the functions of an artist is to delight, to entertain. If you're not giving pleasure of a kind, you are not succeeding as an artist. So even though he takes a great idea, he will not write a tract. He will not write only to his Catholic friends who already understand what he's saying. He is attempting to write to a wide-ranging audience, find a way of reaching that audience and keeping them reading. And it worked. He had millions and millions of readers, and now 50 years after the book is published, it's still selling well. People are still reading it. It's still readable. And one reason is, it is delightful to read. It's very entertaining. It is extremely funny. And on the other end of the spectrum, he always claimed, the other function of the artist was to instruct. And in the midst of the entertainment, you better be teaching a lesson or saying something serious. And indeed, that is going on here too, as I tried to make clear last night. So what do we have? We have a grand idea, a grand theme, in which a mirror is held up to nature and we get something that is recognizable as a time and place, that is presented to a wide-ranging audience, not just a select few, who will be entertained and delighted by what they're being given, but at the same time will be given something of substance, okay? We're at sort of the basic thing that an artist must do. What comes next? I mentioned this last night. Craftsmanship. Craftsmanship. And I tried to point out last night how every single detail in this work is planned, arranged, constructed. He did not just sit down and let the work flow from his pen. He spent time and established parallels, used details. Best example, set up that final ironic, horrible joke of the card that will be sent to Mr. Joyboy. He plans that final wicked joke and plants all the way through the book the earlier card so that we get used to it, we understand, and when that final moment comes, it's prepared for. There is artistry and craftsmanship there. What else? There is an attention to detail. And by that, I don't just mean the shaping of the overall work, but the absolute exquisite nature of every sentence in the work, okay? Every sentence is somehow exquisite. I have just opened the book at random, okay? I am going to just read what my eye happened to fall on to show that we get superbly constructed sentences, stylistically immaculate, that always somehow reinforce the ideas of the book. I'm on page 107, what I just happened to open up to at random. First full paragraph on the page. At the door of the canteen, Mr. Joyboy lingered, sucking a digestive lozenge. The girls came out in ones or twos, lighting their cigarettes. Among them, alone, Amy, who did not smoke. Mr. Joyboy drew her apart into the formal garden. They stood under an allegorical group representing the enigma of existence. Okay? Paragraph chosen at random. It is loaded with things I talked about last night. Okay? The digestive lozenge, somehow controlling nature. The girls lighting their cigarettes, they're not named, they're indiscriminate. They all come out and they do the same thing. They all smoke their cigarettes. Why? They've been told to smoke cigarettes. Amy doesn't. She's one of them. There's something a bit different, which is why Dennis has been attracted to her all along. Mr. Joyboy draws her apart into the formal garden. It goes back to the reference referring to her as an Eve, okay? And suddenly we have this odd sense of the couple going into the garden, and finally the allegorical group representing the enigma of existence, a very serious idea that's been trivialized in the park, okay? It's a little paragraph chosen at random. It is rich and thick with resonances that run throughout the book, and the individual sentences are exquisitely shaped. Each one somehow contributing, adding its own piece to the overall structure of the book. So we have the grand idea, delight, instruction, craftsmanship, style, okay? Exquisite style, attention to detail, every detail somehow being there and contributing to the larger vision. Then we have two things that simply cannot be explained. The first I would simply call the mystery of genius. And that is somehow a great artist is simply a presence in the work. And you pick up a novel by Waugh and it's filled with Evelyn Waugh. It is distinctive. The great artist is somehow distinctive and stands apart from all those others who are attempting to do the same thing and simply don't have clearly defined personality, clearly defined vision, something that makes the art peculiarly their own. Now, some artists that I don't think achieve greatness can achieve personality. You cannot open a Hemingway book and read three sentences and not be aware it's Hemingway. I wouldn't call Hemingway a great writer, but he does possess this quality of personality, which is one reason he is distinctive, and many readers are attracted to him. There is that which simply has to be defined, where you get a feel for the artist in the art. And finally, there's this, all the way back to the Greeks again. What the Homeric poet in those grand epics, sort of at the dawn of the civilized world, prays for from the muses, and that is inspiration. And that is finally inspiration. And it's an X factor. It is again a mystery. The great artists are somehow given a gift. They are touched by something special. Those of us who are believers would say God has given them a special talent and given them a gift that simply the rest of us don't have. Well, how do you know it's there? It's just unmistakable when you read it. And if you are a reader and a close reader, you can tell when someone has been inspired, just simply inspired. It's an odd combination of factors. It's an odd combination of factors. But you put them together and you somehow get art. Now, it's not always the same. Some can simply be gifted with inspiration. Waugh had moments like that. The Loved One was written in a matter of weeks. Simply a matter of weeks. His great novel, Brideshead Revisited, was written in, I think, 2 to 3 months. He got a furlough from the army during the war. He said he had an idea for a book and needed to write it quickly, and they gave him a bit of time, and he went off and wrote it very quickly, which means he simply set it down. I've mentioned before, what do we know about Shakespeare? The claim he never blotted out a line. It just poured out of him. He sat there, he put it down. It's the mystery of Mozart. The manuscripts are absolutely clean. And when he was asked how he did it, he said, the music comes into my head and I just put it down. That's inspiration. The music was a gift from God. As opposed to a Beethoven who would have these small ideas and work for years, and the manuscripts are just a mess as he worked and worked and struggled and sweated and corrected and changed. And you have something like his one great opera that exists in 4 different versions because he worked at it for 14 years. One work, just to make sure he got it right. And at the end, he got it right. Fidelio is a great work. But we can never know the pain and sweat it cost him. So there's not just one way of going about it. But of course, nor could one confuse Beethoven with Mozart or Shakespeare with Waugh. Again, there's something distinctive, different time, different place, different division. But there is that mysterious factor, and there is no doubt that there is some kind of inspiration there. Waugh has it all. There are only a handful of other artists in our time that I think have it all. Flannery O'Connor is one. I would say that Alexander Solzhenitsyn is one. There have been some great writers among us. Not a lot. Most of them will simply vanish. Most of them will simply vanish. And there are those who simply have turned out work that is well-crafted and fun to read. I spent about 2 years of my life reading everything Agatha Christie ever wrote. I was in high school. I didn't waste my time. It was well-crafted. She learned her craft. She did it well. She will not last. I don't regret the time I spent. She knew what she was doing. She did it well. And there was something delightful in those books. Many people have sort of a secret passion. Some like to read science fiction. I don't know science fiction well, but undoubtedly there are some good science fiction writers who are probably good craftsmen and worth reading. But occasionally somebody rises to the surface. Waugh was such a person. And I also think, and let me make this transition, another way in which we can tell that has to do with the lived life. Now, the life of the artist is not necessarily a guide to the art. And there have been great artists whose lives were simply a mess. There's no getting around that. Although, curiously, I would make the claim that the greatest artists, those that have done the greatest work, have a measure of stability in their lives and have certain things in common. The very greatest writers, a Dante, a Cervantes, a Shakespeare, and in this case a Waugh, are men who somehow, in seeking the truth and in attempting to portray the truth, by the end of their lives are settled, and I just gave you a list of men who made good deaths, who were settled at the end of their lives, who, you know, not the usual vision of the artist in torment and agony, but really rather down-to-earth, decent, common people who had their personal problems, but lived a good life, did good work, and made a good end. Now, it was not necessarily clear that Waugh would do that. He was born in 1903. Born in 1903 in London. His father was in the publishing racket and was, in fact, on the board of directors of Chapman and Hall, one of the big publishing houses in London that curiously ended up publishing the books of Arthur Waugh's son, Evelyn. It was a kind of nepotism in one sense, and Arthur was uncomfortable about it, but those who chose to publish Waugh's first novel read it on their own, liked it, and Arthur removed himself from the decision-making process. So he did not decide that the firm he worked at would publish his own son's book. He was educated at Lancing School and then went off to Oxford, and left Oxford without taking a degree. He was notorious there. He learned a lot, but it wasn't in the classroom. And what he learned is chronicled in those early chapters of Brideshead Revisited, where he puts down what life was like at Oxford during those years. He then decided he wanted to be a painter. He had real artistic talent, which I think is another reason for his extraordinary craftsmanship. He knew design, he knew visual design, and he was able to somehow create well-designed works of literary art as well. He studied painting and drafting for a while, then became a schoolmaster in Wales, a job he loathed, briefly was a journalist, and had no idea what to do, and finally, as he puts it, was forced into becoming a novelist, because there was just nothing else he could do. It's very funny. He says he didn't want to, but there was no other option left to him. And in 1928, his first novel was published, called Decline and Fall, that is about a young man from Oxford who finds himself teaching at a school in Wales, and it's indeed based on his early life. But the hero is only slightly like Waugh. The book itself is a vision of the insanity of the modern world. And right from the start, he had a sense that the world into which he had been born was nuts. And he was able to express that insanity through comedy. Now, almost from the beginning, however, in spite of the fact that he saw the insanity all around him, something else was beginning to develop. He was trying to make sense of this insane world in which he found himself. That is, there was in him the desire to comprehend what this was and how it had happened. He was working on a second novel called Vile Bodies, about the bright young things in London, a world of empty partying and good times, which he himself had lived and knew and understood. He was married at about that time, in the very late 20s, about the time that the first book was published, as he was beginning to write the second. And he was married to a woman named Evelyn Gardner. His friends referred to them as he Evelyn and she Evelyn. And it was sort of ironic that the two had the same first name. That haunted him his whole life. He hated his first name. It is not uncommon for a man to be named Evelyn, and the male form is pronounced Evelyn, but you can imagine the confusion it causes. Later in his life, he went to an African country as an emissary of the British government, and he got off the plane, and they were standing there with a bouquet of roses for him because they'd just seen the name and thought a lady was arriving. It was the sort of thing that just infuriated him. But of course, one of the ironies, he married this young woman named Evelyn, and they did it very much on a lark. It wasn't quite what we would call love. There was not necessarily good reason, but they just decided one day to get married and ran off to the justice of the peace and then informed people they were married and decided to settle down, but they just kept their life of partying going on. It became very important in that it was not a happy relationship, although he didn't know it. He didn't know how unhappy his wife was until one day he returned home and she left him a note informing him she was having an affair with one of his good friends and had just run off with the man. It hit him like a bolt out of the blue. He had no suspicion it was going to happen. He didn't know his wife had been unhappy. And suddenly she was gone. The marriage was ended. This occurred while he was writing Vile Bodies, which takes a very dark turn. The book starts out comic and slightly dark and then gets very dark. He went into a profound depression as he wrote to a friend, "I did not know it was possible to be so miserable and still live." But what this did is, once again, it began him examining the kind of world he was living in and the way he had lived his life. Because even though he knew the world was crazy, he had thrown himself into it with a kind of energy. He had been out in it. He'd lived it. He had done all those things that modern young people do. And now he had come to see that it was bankrupt. And not only bankrupt, but positively destructive. And he began trying to figure out if there was something else. And it was at this point, in 1930, when he was 26 years old, that he converted to the Catholic faith. I just want to read a couple of things at this juncture. One is a little comment that he made, written at about the time of his conversion. And I think it gives a sense of what he had come to discover. Civilization, and by this I do not mean talking cinemas and tinned food, nor even surgery and hygienic houses, but the whole moral and artistic organization of Europe, has not in itself the power of survival. It came into being through Christianity, and without it has no significance or power to command allegiance. It is no longer possible, as it was in the time of Gibbon, who wrote Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, as it was in the time of Gibbon, to accept the benefits of civilization and at the same time to deny the supernatural basis on which it rests. Christianity is in greater need of combative strength than it has been for centuries. It's a clear vision. Christianity was vanishing. People were trying to hold on to the civilization that had been built by Christianity, and it wasn't going to work. And he himself was aware of this and began to take the idea of Christianity seriously. Sometime later, he wrote a little apology explaining why he came into the church. I want to take the time to read it because it's fascinating and gives a sense of who the man was and what was going on in his mind. I'll give you a quick synopsis of it. This is just a single comment he made years later after his conversion, when he said, "I reverence the Catholic Church because it is true, not because it is established or an institution," which is wonderful. As he insisted, he became a Catholic because the Catholic faith is true. The priest who gave him instruction said he'd never had such a convert before. Waugh had simply decided the Catholic Church was the true church, came to him, and just wanted to learn what he needed to know. And it was, as Father Darcy said, it was simply intellectual. He had come to believe this, and therefore, tell me what I need to know, because this is true. This is Waugh's own account. "I was born in England in 1903 with a strong hereditary predisposition toward the established church. My family tree burgeons on every twig with Anglican clergymen. My father was what was called a sound churchman. That is to say, he attended church regularly and led an exemplary life. He had no interest in theology. He had no interest in politics, but always voted Tory as his father and grandfather had done. In the same spirit, he was punctilious in his religious duties. At the age of 10, I composed a long and tedious poem about purgatory in the meter of Hiawatha, and to the dismay of my parents, who held a just estimate of my character, expressed my intention of becoming a clergyman. The enthusiasm which my little schoolfellows devoted to birds' eggs and model trains, I turned on church affairs and spoke glibly of Chasubles and Erastianism. I was accordingly sent to the school which was reputed to have the strongest ecclesiastical bent. At the age of 16, I formally notified the school chaplain that there was no God. At the age of 26, I was received into the Catholic Church, to which all subsequent experience has served to confirm my loyalty. I am now invited to explain these vagaries to American readers." It was someone from America that asked him to write this and tell why he converted. "First, of my early religiosity. I am reluctant to deny all reality to that precocious enthusiasm, but it was in the main a hobby like the birds' eggs and model trains of my schoolfellows. The appeal was part hereditary and part aesthetic. Many are drawn in this way throughout their lives. In my case, it was a concomitant of puberty. But those who do not know my country should understand that the aesthetic appeal of the Church of England is unique and peculiar to those islands. Elsewhere, a first interest in the Catholic Church is often kindled in the convert's imagination by the splendors of her worship in contrast to the bleakness and meanness of the Protestant sects. In England, the pull is all the other way. The medieval cathedrals and churches, the rich ceremonies that surround the monarchy, the historic titles of Canterbury and York, the social organization of the country parishes, the traditional, the liturgy composed in the heyday of English prose style, the traditional culture of Oxford and Cambridge, all these are the property of the Church of England, while Catholics meet in modern buildings, often of deplorable design, and are usually served by simple Irish missionaries. The shallowness of my early piety is shown by the ease with which I abandoned it. There are, of course, countless Catholics who, for a part of their lives at least, lose their faith. But it is always after a bitter struggle, usually a moral struggle. I shed my inherited faith as lightheartedly as though it had been an outgrown coat. The circumstances were these. During the First World War, many university dons patriotically volunteered to release young schoolmasters to serve in the army. Among these, there came to my school a leading Oxford theologian, now a bishop. This learned and devout man inadvertently made me an atheist. He explained to his divinity class that none of the books of the Bible were by their supposed authors. He invited us to speculate in the manner of the fourth century on the nature of Christ. When he had removed the inherited axioms of my faith, I found myself quite unable to follow him in the higher flights of logic by which he reconciled his own skepticism with his position as a clergyman. At the same time, I read Pope's Essay on Man. The notes led me to Leibniz, and I began an unguided and half-comprehended study of metaphysics. I advanced far enough to be thoroughly muddled about the nature of cognition. It seems simplest to abandon the quest and assume that man was incapable of knowing anything. I have no doubt I was a prig and a bore. But I think that if I had been a Catholic boy at a Catholic school, I should have found among its teaching orders someone patient enough to examine with me my callow presumption. Also, if I had been fortified by the sacraments, I should have valued my faith too highly to abandon it so capriciously. At my school, I was quite correctly regarded as going through a phase normal to all clever boys and left to find my own way home. The next 10 years of my life are material more suitable to the novelist than the essayist. Those who have read my works will perhaps understand the character of the world into which I exuberantly launched myself. That's the modern world, just out to have a good time in the midst of the lunacy. 10 years of that world sufficed to show me that life there or anywhere was unintelligible and unendurable without God. The conclusion was obvious. The question now arises, why Rome? A Catholic who loses his faith and rediscovers the need of it returns inevitably to the church he left. Why did not I? Here I think the European has some slight advantage over the American. It is possible, I conceive, for a man to grow up in parts of the United States without ever being really aware of the church's unique position. He sees Catholics as one out of a number of admirable societies, each claiming his allegiance. That is not possible for a European. England was Catholic for 900 years, then Protestant for 300, then agnostic for a century. The Catholic structure still lies lightly buried beneath every phase of English life. History, topography, law, archaeology, everywhere reveal Catholic origins. Foreign travel anywhere reveals the local temporary character of the heresies and schisms and the universal eternal character of the church. It was self-evident to me that no heresy or schism could be right and the church wrong. It was possible that all were wrong, that the whole Christian revelation was an imposture or a misconception. But if the Christian revelation was true, then the church was the society founded by Christ, and all other bodies were only good so far as they had salvaged something from the wrecks of the Great Schism and the Reformation. This proposition seemed so plain to me that it admitted of no discussion. It only remained to examine the historical and philosophic grounds for supposing the Christian revelation to be genuine. I was fortunate enough to be introduced to a brilliant and holy priest who undertook to prove this to me, and so on firm intellectual conviction, but with little emotion, I was admitted into the church. My life since then has been an endless, delighted tour of discovery in the huge territory of which I was made free. I have heard it said that some converts in later life look back rather wistfully to the fervor of their first months of faith. With me, it is quite the opposite. I look back aghast at the presumption with which I thought myself suitable for reception, and with wonder at the trust of the priest who saw the possibility of growth in such a dry soul. From time to time, friends outside the church consult me. They are attracted by certain features, repelled or puzzled by others. To them, I can only say, from my own experience, come inside. You cannot know what the church is like from outside. However learned you are in theology, nothing you know amounts to anything in comparison with the knowledge of the simplest actual member of the communion of saints. It's an exquisite piece of writing. It gives a sense of how the man's faith had developed, had grown. He continued to write about that modern world he knew. He wrote from a Catholic perspective that Catholics themselves couldn't always understand. The first novel written after his conversion was called Black Mischief. It is a nasty little book. It is uproariously funny. It is filled with things so outrageous that the leading Catholic journal of the day in England attacked the book for being anti-Catholic. How could this man dare to claim to be a Catholic writer? Waugh wrote a rather impassioned and very persuasive retort, and made very clear that he was a Catholic writer and was rendering the world as he saw it and giving it from a Catholic perspective, but his vision was a vision that he could not deny, and as an artist he had to put it down. The work continued. A magnificent novel called A Handful of Dust that reflects on the collapse of his marriage. And as he puts it, a novel about the bankruptcy of the humanist way of life. And that's what the book is. It's staggering. Many people consider that his greatest novel, called A Handful of Dust. I recommend it to you.